Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Writer's Way, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes toward writing. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Melvina Sykes. We've got a great show for you. Two talented writers open up to us about their writing projects and processes. First up, from the world of sports and entertainment, we have the editor-in-chief of the Shadow League, author Alejandro Danois. He was in town in February 2017 to talk about his book, The Boys of Dunbar, at the Savannah Book Festival. As a Savannah State University student and QEP communications intern, I teamed up with the Tigers Roar sports editor, Kelvin Arms, who is also a student at Savannah State University, in a collaborative reporting operation with a vital mission to find Danois and bring you this interview.
Hello, my name is Kelvin Arms. I'm the Tigers Roar sports editor, Independent News.
And I'm Melvina Sykes. I'm the Office of Quality Enhancement Plan communications intern.
And today we will be interviewing Alejandro Danois, who is the editor-in-chief of the Shadow League and a freelance sports and entertainment writer, whose work has been published by the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun, Associated Press, Bleacher Report, Sporting News, Los Angeles Times, and Ebony Magazine, among others.
His first book, The Boys of Dunbar, A Story of Love, Hope, and Basketball, was released in 2016 and is one of the spotlights in the 2017 Savannah Book Festival. Alejandro Danois tells an encouraging, true story of high school basketball team that gave a city hope, overcoming desperate circumstances in 1980s Baltimore and producing four NBA players. Thank you for joining us, Mr.
Danois. Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm honored and privileged to be here. Thanks, guys. You guys made my day.
Okay, so my first question is, what is your academic background and how long have you been a writer?
Well, I think I've been a writer my entire life. I had a girlfriend in high school tell me that I was a writer and didn't realize it. And when I was in college at the University of Pennsylvania, I thought I was going to become an investment banker and become a millionaire by the age of 25 on Wall Street. And I had one of my English professors say, I don't know what they're doing with you at that business school, but you need to be here with us in the English department because you're a writer. Professionally, about 16 years I've been writing. But even before I got paid to write, I would write short stories, or I was always interested in the written word. To me, I learned early on when I was a kid that reading books just opened up these magical worlds to me. I felt like I could communicate across time and space with some of the greatest minds ever in history. So I always had this intimate relationship and love for books and the written word, and also for sports. And eventually, when I said, you know, I love sports, I love writing, I'm going to put those two together and follow my passions, that's kind of when things took off in terms of me really wanting to pursue my interest as a journalist and a writer.
Okay. And also, you are the editor-in-chief of the Shadow League. Could you tell us a little bit about this magazine, your main responsibilities there?
Okay. Well, the Shadow League is a sports and entertainment internet property. So folks can go to theshadowleague.com and check it out. And Shadow League was actually started by media entrepreneur Keith Klinkscales, who started Vibe Magazine when he was very young with Quincy Jones back in the 90s. Keith has done some really fantastic work in the social media entrepreneur space. He went on to become the highest ranking African-American executive at ESPN. From there, he became the CEO of Puffy, Puff Daddy, P. Diddy, Diddy. I don't know what you guys call him. His Revolt TV platform, Keith was the CEO there. And he also started the Shadow League, which is an internet property. The majority of the writing we do is around sports, but we also do a lot of entertainment stuff, and it's culture. It's society. We do long-form storytelling. We do commentaries on things that are our interests of us. to people of color, but it's not just something that's for African Americans. I mean, it's about sports, it's about entertainment, it's about society, it's about kind of a lot of different pieces coming together. So we're not so much interested in the final score, right? As much as I love LeBron, I don't want to write that LeBron had 50 points, 10 rebounds, and 16 assists. I want to enjoy that as a fan. Mm-hmm. But if I'm writing about LeBron, I want to write about the desperate circumstances he grew up in Akron. I want to talk about the role that his grandmother played. You know, I want to talk about the struggles that his mom went through. I want to talk about how sports was such a galvanizing force in his life, and the brotherhood of those experiences with the teammates he played with, how that helped propel him to a mental space for him to be able to formulate this amazing life vision for himself. So that's what the Shadow League is really about. It's not about the final score. It's not about who won. It's about perspective. It's about intelligence. It's about humor. And sports, as we know, touches on so many different segments of society. So we want to write something that makes people think. We want to write something that makes people really kind of look at themselves and look at the overall world we live in, using sports and entertainment kind of as a jump-off point to really talk about some issues that are serious. But we do it in a way that's, you know, intellectual, and it's also humorous, and we have a great time. So check it out, theshadowleague.com.
Okay. So you are also a freelance writer and have published work in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and Ebony. What is your favorite genre of writing? Is it sports, entertainment, or do you just love it all? How is life as a freelance writer?
Sports is definitely my favorite. I mean, I grew up as a young person really fascinated with sports because it provided an outlet for me to get beyond some circumstances that, you know, were pretty challenging as a young person. So I initially started playing organized sports and realized that the lessons that I learned, the mentors that I had, the structure that it gave me, working towards goals with teammates and trying to work with one another to achieve excellence, those things kind of stayed with me. And so sports have always been, to me, more important than, as we discussed earlier, just who won the game and the final score. I can sit here right now and try to recollect my high school basketball career, my high school football career. I can't tell you how many touchdowns I scored. I can't tell you how many points I averaged or how many assists. I can remember my certain games where I had really good games, but I can remember the bus rides, the jokes. I can remember the bonds. I can call up one of my old buddies now who is doing some work around the athletic shoe business, and he's in China, and we can grab 10 minutes on the phone, and it's like we never separated, even if I hadn't talked to him in 10 years, you know. So sports was always the foundation for me to think about other things and bigger things. And so sports, I think, gives me the opportunity to tell so many different types of stories. I also like the entertainment realm. I was telling Dan, my host for the weekend, that I prefer to work in the candy store of journalism, which is sports and entertainment. But again, there are so many fascinating things that the tentacles of sports and entertainment reach out to, whether it be, you know, business and commerce. If we're going to talk about LeBron, we need to talk about the business of LeBron. LeBron has the opportunity to be the first active billionaire athlete in professional sports through his marketing deals, through his ownership, through being a commercial pitchman, through having his own representation agency where he's actually an agent for other people's in the league. He's going into uncharted territory that we've never seen before. The same can be said for the greatest athlete of our generation and perhaps the greatest athlete of all time in Serena Williams, right? So it's beyond their excellence on the field and on the court. It's really studying the business of LeBron, the business of Serena. And then we can look at some other people like O.J. Simpson, who had possibly the greatest downfall of any one of America's most celebrated athletes. And we get into crime. We get into law and order. We get into so many different elements that, to me, that's what sports writing is all about. Don't send me to the game to write a game story. And I have the ultimate respect for those guys that do that, and they're passionate about it. If I'm at the game and I'm working, I want it to be part of a larger narrative. And quite honestly, I don't really want to work at the game. You know, I want to get my chicken tenders. I want to get my soda. I want to be chilling with my girls. I want to cheer for John Wall and Carmelo and have a good time. But I want to tell stories that matter, that make a difference, that make people laugh and make people cry. And sports is my preferred area to do that. You also asked about life as a freelancer.
Yes.
For people that have an interest in writing and maybe have illusions, or maybe we should call them delusions of grandeur about freelance work, it's a very difficult way to make a living. And then when I began starting as a freelance writer, had to have a full-time job. So, you know, work your full-time job, come home and chase your passion, and work at night, work on the weekends to really kind of hone the craft. But it's a difficult business because you have to be able to deal with rejection. James Patterson was the featured speaker at the opening event last night for the Savannah Film Festival, and he talked about his first, I believe, book proposal that he sent, and it was rejected by 31 publishers. And so now we have this man who's sold over 318 million books, I believe, and he got his start having to deal with failure and rejection. And that's how it is as a freelancer. I mean, a lot of times you will send this story idea and you won't even hear back from someone to say, thanks for submitting, but no, we're not really interested. And you hear no a lot. And so my advice to people is you have to be able to deal with that. You have to be able to say, someone's rejection of my story idea is not a reflection of me or my idea. It's a reflection of their short-sightedness. Because if you really believe in something and you're passionate about it and you put in the work to make it happen, you're going to deliver something that ultimately somebody's going to read and be impacted and touched by. So you have to be able to deal with that and understand, you know, the kind of the classic line, you know, when you're going through a breakup in a relationship is, it's not you, it's me.
Yeah.
Well, when you're dealing with publishers that are rejecting your story ideas, it's not me, it's them. And you just got to plug away. You have to have a faith. It doesn't pay well in the beginning while you're trying to establish yourself. And it can be really, really tough to navigate those waters, but if you are sincere and you're passionate and you're not going to let anything get in your way, you know, you'll find a way to help build your portfolio, build your resume, and be able to get a break, and you'll be ready for it and you'll be prepared for it.
Okay, The Boys of Dunbar, Story of Love, Hope, and Basketball is your first book. When and why did you decide to write a book? Why was it so important for you to tell the story of the Dunbar poet? Just to clarify to our audience, the Dunbar Poets is the name of the basketball team.
Okay, so The Boys of Dunbar, A Story of Love, Hope, and Basketball was a 10-year passion project for me. From the initial process of formulating the idea to the book actually hitting bookshelves was 10 years. 10 years worth of work, blood, sweat, tears. And so what's interesting is that I grew up loving books, as I mentioned earlier. You know, I was a kid who, while other guys in my neighborhood were getting in trouble, if I wasn't playing sports, I was going to the local library because that's where I found these escapes into these stories of these men that I admired and looked up to, whether it be Muhammad Ali, who was my stylistic role model. You know, great NBA players, college basketball players, college football players, whoever they were, their stories spoke to me. So I read books on every athlete I could get a hold of. And, you know, it was interesting when I was younger. I said, man, I'd love to write a book one day. But I didn't start out saying I'm going to write a book about the greatest high school basketball team of all time. And we talked earlier about being a freelancer and kind of working and sending out story ideas and just kind of building your skill set and being prepared when the break comes. I sent this story idea to a major magazine editor. It was a 3-paragraph pitch. And I said, I want to write this story for your magazine on perhaps the greatest high school basketball team of all time. And these were the key figures. And I think it's really fascinating. And so in his prescient wisdom, he got back to me and said, man, this is a great idea, but we're not going to do anything with it. And so I said, well, why, if you think it's a good idea? And he said, well, because I think you have something bigger here. I think this is much bigger than a 1,000-word magazine story. I think you actually have a book idea here. And so we talk about serendipity, you know, putting in the work, being prepared, being at that time and space where the door opens for you because you've put in the work. And luckily, this guy took an interest in me. He called a major literary agency and said, hey, you guys should get in touch with this kid Alejandro because he's got some talent and he's got this wonderful idea. And I got a phone call out of the blue from a major literary agent in New York and said, hey, we talked to this guy at the magazine. He speaks very highly of you. He sent us your 3-paragraph magazine pitch. Are you up for turning that into an 80-page book proposal? And I said, let's do it, you know. And so a lot of hard work went into that, and a lot of research and kind of getting everything together and figuring out how this story was going to go, because I'm accustomed to writing newspaper and magazine stories. I'm not used to writing books. And so now I have to work and figure out this process and how it works. And so it really was serendipitous. And then once I could see the vision and once I could see the pieces in place for me to make the dream become a reality, I went at it with everything I had. And, you know, just put, they say that the million-mile journey starts with the first step. Mm-hmm. And having the thought and the belief that, okay, I got to get started. I'm not going to do anything by standing still. So took those first steps, had some people around me that helped guide me. And I was very, very fortunate that it was well received, that I work with some fantastic people, and that now to see the finished product, that people who read it are really excited about it, it's pretty cool.
Can you explain your writing process a little bit more? Like, once you had the idea and you had the connections, did you set like an agenda to mm-hmm. pace yourself to take the steps to make the book come to life?
Yeah, well, definitely had to put kind of a proposal and an outline together, right? Mm-hmm. Because you always have this initial vision of what you go into, and I'm sure as a sports writer and an editor yourself, you may think you're starting a story out on a certain angle, but the more interviews you do and the more research you do, you come to find out, okay, that's a part of it, but that's not the whole story, and then it kind of grows organically, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, ideally you think through the kind of the outline, and you put together a sketch of what it's going to be. But the more you start to fill in the various hues and the colors and the nuances, things come together. So you definitely, you know, when I was looking at this long-term project, and I do this with some of my shorter magazine stories and some of my work for the Shadow League and some of the other stuff I do for Bleacher Report, you know, I'll have an outline of where I think I wanted to go. I call it my roadmap. But again, a lot of times things will grow organically. So you do the research, you sit down, you kind of meditate. And as a writer, you have to, for me, there's no more exciting feeling in the world than when I'm in the zone. In the same way that Kobe got in the zone and Allen Iverson got in the zone and your favorite player, Dwayne Wade, got in the zone, as a writer, I get in the zone. And when I'm in that zone, I will look up from my computer and realize it's 6 a.m. and I've been writing for 10 hours straight. Now let me get a nap, and I can't wait to get back up, to get back in it, because now everything is flowing and the ideas are going, and I don't feel as alive as I do in those moments. But it really is about planning. It's really about thinking about story architecture and structure. And it's also about understanding that as writers, our words are our babies, and sometimes we'll write something, sleep on it, take a look at it, and go, this ain't gonna do. Gotta rip it up and start again. And we talk about, you know, having a strong, flexible spirit. It's also having the ability to, when you submit something to an editor calling you up and say, you know, the writing is good, but something's not right. Let's trash this and think about it from another angle. So it really is just about being persistent, staying with it, trusting your voice in the direction you want it to go in, rereading, rewriting, re-editing, constantly thinking about it. And the ideas never stop. That's one thing that as writers we're cursed with. We can't stop thinking. We can't turn that off. So I walk with a notepad, and it might be an observation that I see from someone crossing the street, or it may be a conversation that I have with someone that I just met, or it may be a flashback to a scene that I remember from childhood and say, hey man, this would make a great short story. Or I'm reading something and it triggers something in me and says, hey man, let me see if I can track down this former great athlete to see what they're up to or where their life took them, because they were so impactful at one stage and then I don't know what's happened to them. So I'm always writing, I'm always tinkering, I'm always thinking about what's next. Can't turn that faucet off as a writer. It's a gift and it's a curse. But you gotta kind of keep the pen handy. You gotta always think, and you have to understand, how can I fit all of these pieces together to do what I want to do in the limited time that I have.
Okay, and how was your experience of publishing a book? Can you explain this process?
I think I touched on it a little bit earlier. You know, I was very lucky that a prominent agency kind of reached out to me on the behest of a well-known, popular magazine editor. And so, to me, you know, I had things kind of fall into place for me, but I had put in the work to make that happen. So, you know, I acquired a literary agent who walked me through the process of how to put together a solid book proposal, of what needs to be in it, the different dynamics. And it took a lot more work than I thought it would. And so, you know, it's really about having your idea laid out on paper to the point where someone can't say no. And that takes a lot of work, and it's a lot easier said than done. And then, you know, once you have someone that believes in the idea, you have to be able to deliver. And so you got to be disciplined. You got to set times. And, you know, I wish I was just in the space to be able to write 16 hours a day, and that's all I had to do, right? But I have responsibilities as a father. I have responsibilities as a wage earner. There are different things that are part of my life that I need to be committed to, right? And so I've also got to be able to pay the bills. And so sometimes there have been times where I've worked two full-time jobs. I've worked freelance on the side, and I had to write this book. So it was a 10-year journey that you really, really have to believe in, because if you don't, there are so many external distractions that you'll give up. So it's really about stick-to-itiveness and saying, I'm going to get this done. I believe in it. And sometimes you're going to get taken off the path, right? Sometimes you're going to have writer's block. And you're going to go for a full week not having written a word, and then it's going to start to gnaw at you, right? But you fall off the horse, you got to get back on it. You have to seek out mentors who understand the landscape. That's the most important thing, because for someone walking in who didn't have experience in publishing, like, I know I can write, but I don't know how to deal with literary agents and book companies and things of that nature. So I have to have people around me that know that I trust, that can kind of walk me through and show me how things work. And so I was very fortunate in that, you know, I asked a lot of questions because I wanted to know, how does this work? And so now that I have this experience under my belt, I know what not to do on the next book. I know what is advantageous. I know some things that I need to avoid. I know some things that I need to pay a little bit more attention to.
Okay. Well, let's get a little bit more specific in terms of your book, The Boys of Dunbar. So would you compare Coach Way to a coach such as Nick Saban or Coach Calipari?
I would say that there are some similarities in that they both, those three coaches that you named, Nick Saban, the Alabama football coach, John Calipari at the University of Kentucky, and Coach Bob Wade at Dunbar High School in that they produced consistent excellence. And that's something that's very hard to replicate on a consistent basis. Interesting that you bring up the name of John Calipari, because during the time of this book in the early 1980s, John Calipari was an assistant coach at the University of Pittsburgh. And he was one of these assistant coaches that were in the Dunbar Gymnasium hoping to recruit some of the talented players that were coming out of that school and that Bob Wade had coached. So on the athletic ledger, there are some similarities in terms of what they're able to produce. And just having a mind-boggling track record of consistent excellence. It's tough enough to win occasionally and sporadically, but to do so in the manner that they did, there's something else. There's an extra piece to that recipe there that's just a little bit different than the average person or that people on the periphery can really understand. But so the book is about the team that a lot of people think is the greatest high school basketball team of all time. You mentioned Coach Wade. He was a product of the East Baltimore community. He played college football at Morgan State University. He went on to play in the National Football League with the Baltimore Colts, the Washington Redskins, the Denver Broncos, and the Pittsburgh Steelers. But he had some role models and some athletic role models when he was in high school that made his life ambition to come back and be a mentor in his community. So although he played in the NFL, he wasn't blinded by the money. Now, the money was nowhere near comparable to what the guys get today, but it was still decent enough for a 22-year-old kid coming out of college to have something significant in his pocket. But he wasn't blinded because shortly into his NFL career, his wrist was shattered, had surgery, and basically as a defensive back, you can't play with only one hand. So he was forced to retire. And luckily, he had this vision. And in the off seasons, he was going back to get his teaching certification because he wanted to teach back in Baltimore City Public Schools. So you had this tremendous role model who was from the community. And then you just have this amazing compilation of talent, unlike something that was seen ever before. You have four players from this team that eventually go on to play in the NBA. Now, for people that really understand the odds, you know, the chances of one person making it to the NBA are the odds of me hitting the Powerball, right? Me taking Michelle away from Barack Obama in the same day. It's not going to happen. So when we see the LeBrons, right, and we see the Chris Pauls and we see the Carmelos and the Kyrie Irvings, because they're in our living rooms all the time, we just take it for granted. But of the millions of kids that play youth basketball and play high school basketball and then the ones that go to college, the chances of making it are astronomically slim. And so to have four guys that grew up in the same neighborhood together, this wasn't a team that was recruited, right? So you look at some of the top high school basketball teams in the country now, Oak Hill Academy in Mouth of Wilson, Virginia, Montverde Academy in Florida. They not only recruit from all over the country, they recruit from all over the world. Mm-hmm. The recent number one NBA pick was a guy by the name of Ben Simmons who went to Montverde, who's from Australia, right? And so you see this increasing globalization of basketball. To have a team of kids that grew up in the same neighborhood together, that grew up in the recreation centers together before they started playing basketball, where they were doing arts and crafts projects together, they were practicing the latest dances, right? They were riding their roller skates around the city together as kids. And to have them grow up together, for their families to have known each other before they were even born, for the coach to know their families before they were even born, to have this family atmosphere in this wonderful, nurturing African-American community that was struggling through some really tough times, to have a team like that produce four NBA players. But it wasn't just that. Practically the whole team played major Division I basketball. The guy who went on to become the best NBA player out of all of them, Reggie Lewis, didn't even start. But he goes on to become the best NBA player out of all of them and supplants the legendary Larry Bird as the captain of the Boston Celtics. So when you looked at what they all did in college, what they all did in the NBA, Muggsy Bogues is the shortest player ever in the history of the NBA. He could dominate a game without scoring a point. And for people that don't understand basketball, they don't understand how difficult that is, right? Everybody's in love with Steph Curry and how much these guys score now. Muggsy didn't have to score to be the best player on the court. He could dominate the game in so many different chambers, whether it be as a defender, as a passer, as a leader, that he was a marvel. We've already seen a reasonable facsimile of the player that everyone considers the greatest ever in Michael Jordan, in Kobe Bryant, right? Mm-hmm. I believe we'll see 10 more Michael Jordans before we see another Muggsy Bogues. And so when you look at the talent, when you look at the what they did in college, you know, Muggsy at Wake Forest, Reggie and David Wingate at Georgetown winning the national championship, Reggie Lewis at Northeastern University in Boston, who goes on to the NBA, and you got four guys who grew up together since they were little kids. In the NBA, you have a bunch of other guys who played major Division I college basketball. One of them played major college football. And so just to see how that came together and what they did afterwards and just to think about what happened, it's a story that's much bigger than basketball.
You have just listened to an interview with Alejandro Danois, a critically acclaimed author who presented his book at the Savannah Book Festival and visited us at Savannah State University. We will have a 1-minute break and we will be back with another interview with Jemiah Nabawi, an amazing storyteller and author of several books. Stay tuned.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yant, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
I am Sarah Dillard, a sophomore majoring in civil engineering and technology at Savannah State University. As a peer tutor at the SSU Writing Center, I bring you the Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day. If you know you have problems using punctuation correctly, try editing a new way. Circle every punctuation mark in your essay. If you find several commas in one sentence, or if you realize you have gone 5 lines without seeing a period, you will know to fix those errors.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Writer's Way, a Right Attitude radio show. I'm Melvina Sykes. Next up, we have storyteller Jemiah Nabawi, author of several children's books such as Why Spiders Hide in Corners, The Essential Br'er Rabbit, Three Tails Tall Sungura, and many others. Nabawi performed at the 13th Annual Savannah Children's Book Festival in November 2016 and visited Savannah State's campus in February 2017 to present the QEP Lunch and Learn, a monthly event where we give students an opportunity to connect with community leaders, writers, and professionals so they can see how important writing is in the workplace. Let's listen to his interview that I had the pleasure to conduct.
Hello, my name is Melvina Sykes. I'm the QEP Communications Intern, and today we have with us Mr. Jemiah Nabawi.
Yes.
A native of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, he is an award-winning multifaceted storyteller. His upbeat storytelling reflects the story, dance, musical, drama found in many parts of Africa and its diaspora. Jemiah also tells and adapts stories from around the world. Through his presentations, he has often served as cultural ambassador, program host, and parent engagement facilitator at various venues, presenting culturally entertaining, family-friendly children's programs and educational workshops. He is the author of several books, with his latest being Three Tales of Sungura, The Great Bell of China, and Br'er Rabbit.
That's
great. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Nabawi.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so my first question to you. Being a storyteller is a very unique profession. You don't just meet many people who are storytellers. How did you begin this craft, and what made you say, I want to be a storyteller?
Good question. That's my favorite question to answer, and I'll give you the short version. I had been living in Mexico, Guadalajara, for many years before returning to Philadelphia. So when I got back home, I wanted to see what was going on. You know, I'm reading the papers, and I said, oh, I see this announcement for a traditional African griot appearing at the Philadelphia Art Museum. Mm-hmm. So I get to the art museum, and there's Jimu Kuyate, the late Jimu Kuyate. He's got this beautiful instrument called the kora, and he's playing, and he's singing, and he's telling stories. In between telling stories, he's using Mandinka language.
Yes.
And I was just like, wow, he's in this African garb and costume. It was just beautiful. So I enjoyed the program. Afterwards, of course, I introduced myself and told him how much I enjoyed the program, and that was it. The following weekend, still seeing what's going on in Philly, I see Linda Goss, the official storyteller of Philadelphia. She's in this garb, and she's got all these colors and the bells.
Yeah.
I said, oh, what is all this storytelling stuff going mm-hmm. on? So I get to the Please Touch Museum, is where she was performing. I got there a little late, and as I walked in, she already had things going in her performance. And one potato, two potato, two potatoes, four, mm-hmm. have you heard? Spread the word. She was, the kids were responding, and it was actually a happening. So I'm like, wow, this is wonderful. So after it was all over, I again introduced myself, told her it was how much I enjoyed the program. And then she asked me, she says, well, where are you from? I said, oh, I'm from Philly. She said, well, I hear an accent. Well, I had come back from Mexico. I lived there like 4 years with a little accent. You know, I said, no, I'm from here. I said, well, how does someone get involved with this storytelling thing, with what you're doing? She says, well, you take workshops, you know, you find a mentor, you read books, you know, there's all kinds of ways. She says, you're welcome to come to my workshop. So I went to her workshop. That was in July of 1986. And from that day to this very moment, I've been telling stories.
Okay.
She took me under her wing and introduced me. I would go to school programs with her. And but what really thrusted me into it, she says, Jemiah, I have a job for you. Because I thought I was looking for work, just home. And I said, I'm an electrician, I'll wash dishes. I just want work because I'm going to college. Mm-hmm. I was going to Community College of Philadelphia. So she calls me, says, Jemiah, I have a job for you. I said, oh, okay, wow, cool. I'm thinking electrician, electrician's helper, washing dishes, whatever. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, all right, well, doing what? She says, telling stories. I panicked. I said, wait a minute. I said, Linda, I just took your workshop. I said, I'm not a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
She says, oh, don't worry. She says, just, you know, the way you told me how you lived in Mexico. She says, that's storytelling. There's all kinds of ways to tell stories. So she says, I'm going to give you a book. She gave me this book called The Knee-High Man.
Mm-hmm.
She said, read this story, and by next weekend, be prepared to tell it. This is all new to me. I said, Linda, you expect me to read all this and then go back and tell it? She says, no. She says, you read it to get the story idea. Mm-hmm. Then you go back and you retell it. So this is all new to me. I haven't heard retelling those phrases before. I said, okay. I said, but Linda, I really wish you had called me first. I don't feel comfortable with this. She says, Jemiah, you'll be fine. Well, long story short, I asked her, eventually, I said, you said they were going to pay me? She said, oh, yeah, they're going to pay you. I said, how much? She said, $150. I said, what? This was 1986,
yeah.
$150 for 45 minutes. Yeah. I said, give me that book.
Right.
And that's how it all began, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what type of stories do you tell, and what is it that you love about storytelling?
Well, I tell because I started with Linda. She did a lot of children's programs, family programs. So that's pretty much my niche. I tell African folk tales primarily because of it suits my personality in that I like to move and sing and do rhythms and play and things like that. So I tell African folk tales, but I also tell tales from around the world. I retell them, or I might see a story that has something in it that I like, and I will just create a story from that little nugget of information.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the type of stories I like. And the reason why is because if the story lends itself, or if I can see where I can play in it or get children or adults even to play while I'm telling the story, then that's pretty much what I lean towards.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I've read that you took time to learn multiple languages to help enhance your storytelling. How do you keep yourself motivated to continuously find ways to enhance your craft?
Well, I tell you, quite honestly, the children keep me motivated. I look out there and I see faces of all types and colors and races, and that's been my joy for the past 30 years. I look out into the audience and these kids are participating, teachers are participating, and that's what really prompted me when I saw that, okay, I said, this is what I do. This is what I'm going to be doing. My audiences are international, so let me learn some other languages or even just a phrase. I'm bilingual in Spanish. I speak a little French, but I learned phrases and songs in other languages just to, some for surprise, you know, and fun. I sing a song in Japanese or Yoruba, and those kinds of things keep me motivated. Mm-hmm. If I can communicate with the people in their language or a little phrase of their language and tell a tale and see some joy on their faces, see some enlightenment happen, and it works both ways, I become enlightened too. That's what keeps me motivated.
Okay. Well, some of the stories that you tell have been passed down. Would you say that you also have a love for history?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Actually, since being here in Savannah, which is like, 18 years now, I've become a tour guide. Mm-hmm. And what got me, kept me connected with history is that, you know, in learning the folklore of the different peoples and whatnot, you, of course, they incorporate some history, and then storytelling is a way to keep a history, to keep that continuum of a people's past or of a family's past going, you know, through storytelling. So that's always interested me. And then since being here in Savannah, the more I learned about Savannah, I said, well, wait a minute. Savannah has a connection from where I'm from Philly, Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. You know, there's Franklin Square. You know, Ben Franklin used to be down here recruiting people for the Revolutionary War, the Franklin Square. And then, of course, from Independence Mall, when the Declaration of Independence was signed there in Philadelphia, Independence Mall, a few months later in August, it was down here. It was read to the public right here in Johnson Square in Savannah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I have a historical connection that way too. And one last thing, I was born in the oldest hospital in the United States, in Philadelphia.
Really?
That connects to Savannah some kind of way too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, after experiencing your storytelling, how do you want your audience to feel? How do you hope to impact them?
Well, the first thing is that it's a release. It's a joyful moment. Mm-hmm. You know, because I tell engaging storytellers. I like to play. And at the same time, impart information. So, if there's been some some joy and some smiles and some enlightenment, leave them enlightened, because I want to find something that they may not know and give a little information within the story, you know, that's how I would like to leave them.
Okay. So what role has writing played in your successful career as a storyteller?
Well, you know, the books that I'm doing now are actually from stories that I've told over the years. Like, take one, the Anansi story. That's a traditional trickster character, origins from with the Ashanti, all over the Caribbean, especially Jamaica, you see. So I found that in writing these stories down, I said, wait a minute, you know, this is literary now. So things change a bit. So the more I started writing and trying to easily write what I could easily tell, it took me back a bit. I had to, you know, on paper, the literary piece is different in that, you know, you have to think about your word choices. In storytelling, you just tell the story. Mm-hmm. You just tell the story. So it's enlightened me to different writing mechanics. Also, it's led me to other information as I research to do something more with the story and do research. So it's really helped me with writing, you know, with retelling stories. Mm-hmm. And it's broadened my range, I should say, in retelling a story.
So can you tell us about your latest book, Three Tales of Sangura, The Bell of China, Br'er Rabbit?
Yes, Three Tales Tall is a series that an idea came to me. It's, Three Tales Tall. So it's a book. There's several books. Mm-hmm. Each Three Tales Tall book has three stories. That's the whole thing. And these are stories that are, they're maybe a folk tale or maybe a story, not just from Africa, but from wherever I see a story that I like, that I can retell or see something in it to actually compose a whole new story.
Yeah.
So Sangura is from Kenya, and it's a traditional trickster character from Kenya. Sangura Mjanja is his full name. It's Swahili for clever rabbit. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And so Sangura, like Anansi and other folk tales, have fallen back into obscurity because, you know, at one time when it was popular for the publishing houses to publish them and make these big, beautiful, colorful books for children out of them, well, that's pretty much fallen back. And not only that, there were only a few select authors that were chosen to get printed, you see. So my mission is, with the Three Tales Tall, is to get those once popular stories, folk tales. Sangura is from Kenya. A lot of Kenyans would know about Sangura Mjanja, but you're not going to see books published about Sangura Mjanja. So I retell this. It's not even retelling. I use the character to tell a story about water conservation. The subtitle for Sangura is Tunataka Maji Sasa, which is Swahili for "We want water now." You see, and then the other story is the Great Bell of China, which is a Chinese story, and it's an element in there that's good for discussion because one of the characters, the daughter, the daughter sacrifices her life for her father to keep her father from being beheaded. You know, and again, I take out a lot of gory details in some of these stories because, you know, it's just my way. So that's from China. And I met a lady who had remembered that story when she was a little girl. And so, I mean, that was just, and this lady, you know, she was an elder woman, I would say, late 70s, early 80s. And she told me she read that as a kid. I was like, wow. So I look for those type of obscure stories that aren't being told anymore. And then the last one, Br'er Rabbit, is, and it's spelled intentionally B-R-U-H, Br'er. You see, but people are used to seeing Br'er Rabbit. Now, the Br'er Rabbit tales are very popular with the Joel Chandler series, and his Uncle Remus series, and a lot of folks, you know, kind of had put that down. But what they didn't get from it was, as Reverend Faulkner would say, they threw away, almost threw away the baby with the bathwater, because those Br'er Rabbit tales were pretty much on salvation during enslavement. You know, told these stories and told tales. However, this Br'er Rabbit, a lot of folks don't know about this Br'er Rabbit that's in Three Tales Tall, is the story of a protest tale. So a lot of Br'er Rabbit tales were protest stories against slavery. That a lot of, you know, a lot of folks, unless you're a storyteller, you've done some research, or you knew. In my case, I was blessed to actually know Reverend Faulkner's family, who preserved that Br'er Rabbit tale that was passed on to Reverend Faulkner as a little boy at 10 years old by a once enslaved African descendant named Simon Brown. And this, very briefly, the story is about Br'er Tiger and the Big Wind. Br'er Tiger represents the big system, and he keeps all the little short-tailed animals from coming over to get some food during the famine.
Get away from me, I'll eat you up, you come over here.
You see, then Br'er Rabbit comes along. He's the clever one. He's small in size, but he's clever, you know, and he gets them all together.
Everybody, y'all gather around. I got a plan.
And so he comes up with a plan to create this sound of a big wind. Br'er Bear comes with a great big old log and start a big old tree limb and start beating on the log. Bigger bam, bigger bam, bigger bam, bam, bam. And then inside the log, Sister Cuda, she's jumping. Bigger boom, bigger boom, bigger boom, boom, boom. And then all the birds in the trees, the leaves are flying and the trees are bending and the people are crying. Tie me, ba-rabbit, tie me. 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 And then Bert Tiger, you see, he hears all this. Hey, what's going on out there? What's going on? Bert Rabbit says, oh, there's a great big wind that's coming through the woods, going to blow us to freedom. Mm-hmm. He said, what big wind? Long story short, anyway, they fooled Bert Tiger. He thinks there's really a big wind that's going to blow him off the face of the earth. So he asked Bert Rabbit, Bert Rabbit, you get over here and tie me to this pine tree so the wind won't blow me off the earth. And Bert Rabbit said, oh, man, I'll come over and tie your hide to the tree, too. And he ties this vine, takes this big vine and ties Bert Tiger to the tree. And Bert Tiger tried to pitch and pull. He said, a little tighter. He ties him up. Now he's got Bert Tiger tied up. And Bert Rabbit said, all right, Chili, come on out here. Hush your fuss. Come on in and help yourself to the food. Because the good Lord put it here for everybody to get some. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much the short version of that story.
That's pretty clever. What is your writing process, and could you please share with us and our audience a step-by-step guide to your writing process?
Well, that's, you know,
as much as you can.
Yeah, actually, I hadn't really thought about it in a way. I don't work with a particular form, but as I said earlier, there are two teachers that I had in my English class that I keep in front of me. So the first part of the process is to write. Mm-hmm. You know, I have an idea, you have a story idea, you just start writing it. You know, everyone has writer's block somewhere, you know, you're going to get stuck somewhere. Some people have the talent, they just keep on writing. But I'm just saying, for those of us who get that stuck. All right, so you get started, that starts the process. And then from there, let's say I'm in, what am I going to say next? I'll take a break, and then I'll come back, and I'll make a list of, okay, what other characters can I put into this story? You know, if I'm creating a story, this is how it started out. This is what I want to add to it. So when I come back and start adding things that I would like to see happen or just ideas, mm-hmm. I'm back to writing again. And then eventually I may discover something, so, oh, wow, I'm going to put that into the story.
Yeah.
And I'll go back to writing. And then the third one is I look at the genre, you know, if there's a particular author that pretty much writes what I like to read, I'll look at her or look at him and see what they've said, how mm-hmm. they've said it, and they're pretty much the three primary things that I use.
The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's Quality Enhancement Plan, a campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by improving their attitudes toward writing. In your opinion, how can we improve our attitude about writing?
I would say, write something and publish it. Go to CreateSpace, because this is a great place to start. It's, mm-hmm. it's so user-friendly. So let's say, I'm not a writer or whatever. You've got some poetry, you've got some rhyme, you've got a little story, you've got whatever you've written, a testimony, you know, it's all stories. A family, grandma said, you know, a recipes. Go to CreateSpace, follow the prompts, and then when it's all done and you get your proof back, your book back, it's going to cost a couple of dollars, not expensive, mm-hmm. and you have it in your hand, any reluctant writer or reader is going to say, wow, because you've got your product in your hand and you are published. That's very motivational.
Yeah. So would you mind telling us a quick story?
I'll tell you a quick story. Let's see. I'm going to tell a quick story. I'm going to give you the short version of my latest book. It's called Nana Binya's Talking Sweet Potatoes. And what I like about this story, it promotes a linguistic artifact. As I say, it promotes the language Gullah. Mm-hmm. It promotes the Gullah Geechee culture. Again, another aspect of our history that, you know, if you're not careful, it'll fall to the wayside. So here's the version that I tell. Nana Binya was a pie maker, but she did quite a lot of things. And but she was always given to the community. Three things she loved doing the most is service to her community, baking pies, and knitting, you see. So she wanted to make some pies. And whenever she got in the mood of baking pies, she had to sing her little ditty. Oh me, oh me, oh me, oh my, me want some sweet potato pie. Oh me, oh me, oh me, oh my, me want some sweet potato pie. So there she is. She goes down to get up some sweet potatoes. She puts some into a sweet grass basket. She goes down again and she puts them in the basket. She goes down again and she puts them in the basket. She gets back home and she starts preparing those sweet potatoes. And you know she's got all the ingredients going after she sliced them up. And oh, she's putting in this. She's putting in that. She's putting in that. She's putting in this. And the batter's ready. She put those pie in the oven. And you know when Nana Benya makes sweet potato pies, it was a one of the neighbors walking down the road, he said, oh, Nana Ben, you've got this whole block lit up with those sweet potato pies. He said, yeah, child, how honey for do that? Yeah, take it. Yeah, I haven't put the table to the record. Y'all come on down here and get some. So Nana Ben, she got her pies baking, and as soon as they're ready, just so happened, great timing. Her grandkids show up with their friends. Hey, Nana, can we get some pie? Yeah, go in the kitchen and get some pie. Can I take one home with me? Because she, you know, one of the neighbors wanted to take his home early. So they're in the kitchen, they're eating pie, and some things fall on the floor. She said, hey, y'all going out there in the yard and play? Hey, get out that kitchen there. She goes out the kitchen to see what's going on, what was left. They had eaten all the pies. She said, huh? Them children done yum all we pie. They done yum all we pie, yeah. Look, yeah. She said, they had no pie. She didn't eat. They've eaten all the pie, you know? So what they going to do now? What's she going to do? Because the people, her neighbors expect the pie. You know, she's making pie. So the word got out that Nana didn't want to give out her pie. She didn't have any more. So, but the people felt that she just didn't want to give them pies anymore for some reason. So they were upset. Some stopped speaking to her. Was, you know, they were just upset. Now the son, you see, the son is up there. The son sees all this. And, you know, the son and mother, they're very two powerful characters. And they can keep our food supply going. So the son and mother, if they communicate and they come up with a plan to help Nana out. And so Nana goes down to the vegetable garden. She goes to pull up some more sweet potatoes and make more sweet potato pie. And those sweet potatoes act like they didn't want to budge. She pulls the sweet potatoes up again, act like they didn't want to budge. And the son is up there in the sky now. He's smiling because the son had done something. So she goes to pull that sweet potato up again and got the surprise of her life. The sweet potatoes started talking. The sweet potatoes said, go away, leave us alone. We don't want to be no sweet potato pie. She said, huh? Am I hearing things? She goes down and pulls the sweet potatoes up again. She said, go away, leave us alone. We don't want to be in a sweet potato pie. She said, oh my goodness. Now dog Toby did bark. But then Toby spoke too. You better listen to those sweet potatoes. She said, oh my goodness. Now she's frightened now. So she goes to the tree nearby. She snatches a branch from the tree to protect herself. Mm-hmm. She snatched that branch from the tree, and the tree says, hey, lady, put my branch down. She said, oh my goodness. She goes to put the branch down, but before she does, the branch says, put me down slowly, please. And she drops it on the rock. You know, one of those big old sedentary rocks there, and the rock says, hey, you get that thing off me, woman. Nana Binion's upset. She's frightened.
Yeah.
She runs out the vegetable garden, runs down the road, just happened to be running by her cousin Essie's house. And her cousin says, hey, child, you slow down. Where you going off in such a rush? And the fisherman who was there said, like you saw a ghost or something. So Nana Benya told him what was going on at the garden. They didn't believe it until the sweetgrass basket that cousin Essie was making. The basket hears the story, and the basket starts speaking too. The basket said, hey, ain't nothing to be all upset about. We talk all the time. She said, huh? She drops that basket. They all run off the porch, run down the city hall. They're going to tell the mayor. Run past the guard right there at the front desk. Run up the spout staircase. And there's the mayor. She's sitting in the office, you see. They're in there talking. Hey, you had to come here. Look, yeah, woman, you need to come talk about these people. They're all talking across each other. She said, wait a minute, one at a time. What's all the ruckus about? The sweet potatoes, they don't know if they crack their teeth, yeah. The fisherman said, yeah, I heard it with my own ears. And my cousin actually said, and my sweet grass basket started talking too. Now, the mayor, she smiles. She says, this is some practical joke or something. Is so, okay. So you all are the welcoming committee to welcome me as your new mayor. No, child, you need to come see this thing here. And before they could leave, the grandfather clock majestically in the corner rings the time. Blum. 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 And then it spoke too. Talking sweet potatoes? Now that's cool. This is a what? They run out of there so fast. Well, they get back to the garden the next day. Now they figured something out. They say, hey, look, we get these sweet potatoes to talk. Maybe we can make some money off them. They get back down to the garden. Nana pulls the sweet potato. Nothing. She looks at the dog. Toby, crack your teeth. Say something. Nothing. Meanwhile, nothing speaking. So at the end of the day, Nana Bean, she picked up some sweet potatoes, take them back home. They're all in her house now. She baked some pies, and they're all sitting around eating sweet potato pies and telling tales. And that's the end of the story.
You have just listened to our second and last interview. That's it for this episode of The Writer's Way. A big thank you to everyone who helped make this show possible and to our guests, Alejandro Danois and Jemiah Nabawi. Thanks to the QEPs, Adriana de Oliveira and Lisa Yant. To Dustin Michael for his help in production and Grace Curry at WHCJ for her support. Tune in next time for more episodes of The Writer's Way. I'm Elvina Sykes. Thanks for listening and keep writing. Don't forget that you can listen to all of the Right Attitude radio shows by visiting the Quality Enhancement Plan website, qep.savannahstate.edu. Also, please follow us on Facebook at WriteSSU, Twitter at WriteSSU, and Instagram at Write_SSU.